Okay, we're back from executive session to discuss a real property matter. And first on the council, so we will resume our regular meeting. First on council action items is the purchase and sale agreement for the Gateway property, which is what council just discussed. And after discussion, we'd like to sincerely thank the purchasers, but we have decided that the intended use of the property, it does not really meet the goals that we had set for a long time. We've talked about our goals for the use of that property, and these uses do not fit with that. So we thank you very much for the offer. But and pardon? No, no price at this time. So thank you very much. Okay, next we move on to our second action item, which is Ordinance 18-2910, amending Section 3.80, Development Impact Fees, to adjust the fee calculations method and add a fee deferral. So do we need to discuss this further? We had a presentation on this. So does someone want to make a motion to approve this ordinance?
I move to approve the ordinance as written.
Okay, is there a second to that motion?
I second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved by Councilor Rule and seconded by Councilor Davidson to approve this ordinance 18-2910. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
Okay. Motion carried 5-1. Okay, next item is Resolution 1730-18, updating unified fee schedule to increase development impact fees. Would somebody like to make a motion to approve this? Or is there further discussion? Or do we want to postpone this action item? Do I have a motion?
Yeah, I'll still move.
Second? Okay, it's been moved by Councilor Hawkins, seconded by Councilor Rule. Is there any discussion on updating the fee schedule to increase development impact fees?
By looking at the presentation that we had this evening and the study session that we had prior, I see this as a move to put us competitive but even lower than our neighbors. So it makes sense to me to align this with current times and current expenses.
Why are we trying to be the lowest in the block with this kind of a deal? Those of us who've lived here for a long time have been paying through we paid the levy for 20 years to fix our roads up and stuff like that. And the people that are coming in here get the benefit of that. And they haven't been paying the property taxes on the house. They may be paying a small fee, property tax fee, but they haven't paid the real cost for these roads and stuff like that. And I don't understand why we're trying to be the lowest in the county. Why aren't we competitive with Linden? Why aren't we the same level with Linden or Ferndale? I don't understand why we're trying to be so low. Like, it's going to keep somebody from building a house in Blaine. It isn't going to keep somebody from building a house in Blaine. All you have to do is have the available lots, and that's the issue we have in Blaine. So I think we should make it more realistic of what we should be collecting.
Any other comments?
I just would like some clarification. The Ordinance 18-2910 and the Resolution 1730-18, how do they differ? I mean, it looks like we're voting on the same increase in fees. One just looks like there's some fire stuff involved. So.
Perhaps I can address that. So the ordinance actually changes our
code and changes the formulas in the code that come up with the fees, but the resolution actually is the instrument that changes the actual fee. And so, yeah, I could expand on that, but that's
well, that's
so
that's
fine. How do we come up with $1,500? I guess it's why is it closer to what our neighbors are paying?
Either of the council members on Parkman?
So from the Public Works Committee, we've discussed this for many months, what, a year maybe? And part of the reasoning is, you know, we knew that we were the bottom, I guess, bottom three, so maybe the bottom 5% of the state. Part of the issue is, you know, there was initial talk about going up to $2,100, maybe $3,000 to kind of get us in line with the state average, but we felt like that was too much too soon. And part of the issue is, had we raised it up X percentage every year for the past 20 years, we wouldn't be having this discussion, but we hadn't. So we felt like essentially more than doubling the impact fee from, you know, last year to this year was a big one. And I feel that after seeing the fact that we're still 40% of the state average, that potentially over the next few years we may have to increase it again. But I think this was the initial kind of, you know, doubling it is a lot, and I think that's how the Public Works Committee felt. Do you have anything to add, Mary Lou, as far as that goes?
No. Okay. Madam Mayor, may I provide a little sort of a technical kind of clarification?
Talk really close.
We're working on getting a request for a new system on the street, just
please,
by the way. So the way that the formula is set up, and I think that Alex and Raven explained this in prior meetings and probably touched on it tonight, is the formula that's been adopted in the code that you just passed would require that we bring forward a fee every year because it's based on our six-year transportation and six-year park improvement plans. So this is the fee for the upcoming year, and in the beginning of each year after you've passed the capital improvement plan with the budget, we will come forward and say, so here's what that means budget-wise. We'll present that during the budget process, and you'll be able to recalibrate the fee each time. And we'll be recommending that you keep it somewhat stable, but much like Mr. Davidson just said, it will probably have to be adjusted to stay in line with the needs. But it is important to recognize this is the fee this year. Next year, with the new capital improvement plan, with new list of projects at new costs, we'll be saying this is what we feel is the appropriate fee, and you'll be voting on it again. It'll be it's part of the budget each year, or right after the budget's approved each year.
The way I interpret this increase is it seems like a fairly big jump, especially in the traffic impact fees. But I think we're kind of catching up. We've got to increase it substantially this year to catch up. And we will be reviewing and see if we want to increase it next year. We may or may not do that. We're going to have to assess that in the process. But I think that's, you know, the traffic one has been increased substantially, not as much as we maybe could have. Or maybe some would say should have, but it seems to be a good starting point to begin from here on. And no, we don't necessarily need to be the lowest, Charlie, that's for sure. But we also do need to grow our residential areas. And, you know, I think it bears thinking about that we don't get too high, because it might be a little bit of an incentive for people to build here rather than another community. So we have a motion.
I just like to have a little further discussion in that I tend to agree with Councilmember Hawkins in that what we have in Blaine is space. And perhaps as developers are looking at where they're going to develop, it's not going to be necessarily who has the lowest impact. We're not working in that world. We have more space here than any of the places that we looked at, more opportunity to build. And considering our overall budget needs, it's really something to think about, that we really need to think about how we're going to pay for the things that we need to pay for. And I appreciate his thought about bringing in new development and that way of increasing our revenue. I think it's worth pause.
Okay, so there's a motion on the floor. Are we all ready to vote? Okay, all those in favor of the motion to pass Resolution 1730-18, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
Okay, motion passes 5-1. Okay, next is an amendment to the Boblett Properties, which is Yorkston, purchase and sale agreement. Mr. Sitkin's going to give us some information on this before voting.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This amendment is a second amendment, Second amendment that comes on containing basically two amendments, if you will. And I'm going to let you know that this property is purchase transaction is still in its current feasibility period. The developer has now submitted the proposed lot line adjustment binding site plan proposals to the city and to Public Works for review. Their Public Works, I understand, is working through that review with planning. And the developer has asked to extend the feasibility period by 30 days to allow them to engage with Public Works and complete that review. So that's one component. The other component, as you will recall, is that we made estimates of the area based upon aerial photograph and information that had been available at that time in the square footage. But we had the price per square foot set. So we were going to come back once we had the survey that Boblett prepared to finalize those numbers. That's the first part of the amendment. We have the final numbers with the adjustments to the land area of what we understood. The land area is to be, it'll be based upon the site plan that's been presented by Boblett. The total adjusted purchase price is $279,867 and some cents. It's an increase by about $11,000. The purchase areas that'll be changed, the areas, the Boblett area will be reduced by about 4,000 square feet of what it's purchasing. We have the reserved easement area, which is really close to this estimated area. The SR 443 will be modestly reduced in square footage as well. And then there's some adjustments to the above right-of-way areas. But in net and sum, it's an increase in the purchase price paid by Boblett by about $11,000. So that's on for your approval tonight. Staff and my office recommend approval of the amendment to extend and confirm the final square footages and pricing.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Sitkin on this?
Your motion to approve and authorize the city manager to execute the amendment.
So the amendment is to increase the purchase price.
To adjust the purchase. Ultimately, it has an adjustment, the purchase price up. It's to finalize the square footages for the properties being transacted that result in an increase in the purchase price, and it extends the feasibility period 30 days. So the motion would be to approve the second amendment as presented and authorize the city manager to execute the same.
Okay, would someone like to make a motion?
I move as such. So move.
I'll second.
Moved and second. Moved by Councilor Stewart and seconded by Councilor Lawrenson to approve the amendment to the purchase and sale agreement of the Boblett properties. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carried 6-0. Okay, next is City of Blaine election procedures, board voting procedures. Mr. Sitkin, going to give us some information.
I understood council had a question that was raised regarding the new Voting Rights Act in the state of Washington and the ward system that you have and the general voting that you have at the final general election. I wasn't sure what the precise question was regarding the Voting Rights Act, but I can give you a bit of an overview, and maybe in that I'll address the questions that someone had or the question that was presented. I would. So is that all right? Or unless there's a particular
okay.
question
Does anybody
you want
have
to
a specific question of Mr. Sitkin, or should we just have him proceed?
So okay. The state legislature did in this last session pass what's called the Voting Rights Act for the state of Washington, follows the federal Voting Rights Act. Its design, and this is important through this discussion, its design and intent is to allow an equal opportunity to elect council members and to allow the protected classes the equal opportunity to elect. It is not saying how representative voting is to occur or how representation is to occur. It still follows the same methods for establishing a district, provided you aren't discriminating. So the whole intent is for to have an electoral system that does not discriminate on or deny any race, color, or language protected classes. So those are the three protected classes, race, language, and color. So your legislature intends to allow a process for local governments who have the ward-based primary with the general population voting at the general election to modify their system to avoid the deleterious effects that could result on or effects of polarized voting or biased systems that are discriminatory on the race, color, language protected classes. I want to say that I have not seen or been aware of any kind of allegation that the city of Blaine has any voting system that violates or infringes the rights of a protected class, race, color, language. This allows the citizens to bring forward a notice to you if there is a claim of a violation of an electoral system that violates the rights of a protected class, denies the equal opportunity to vote for somebody, that your system is gerrymandered, if you will, or constructed in a way that a person is denied the opportunity to vote for somebody through a general election that they think would otherwise get through the ward system. The process would be a person would bring notice to the council would investigate it, you could develop a plan, hold public hearings, you'd have to do public notice of the claim that there was a violation, you would then decide whether you think there was an issue or not, and if you thought there was an issue that your system was violating a race, color, or language protected class, you would make your changes. You would go to court, get the court to verify that, and go through that process. If someone made the petition to you and a complaint about the system and you denied it, they have a right of action to go to court. So while this allows you to change the voting system conceivably to be ward only all the way through the general, it would be on the basis of a circumstance where there was a violation of an equal protection and the equal opportunity to participate in elections and vote. There's findings that would have to be made to be going through that process. So it isn't as easy as saying, well, the legislature provided an opportunity for a city or any form of government to change its voting method away from the general election and citywide voting. It wasn't that carte blanche. It is in response to a claim that someone's denied equal protection. That's my read of the law. Does that address and answer the question?
I think so.
I just a point for specificity for me. I know what race and color is, obviously, but language, legal-wise, what do you mean by language? I don't want to think that it's something it's not. So,
a language minority group is what the definition of a protected class in the statute means, a class of voters who are members of a race, color, or language minority group. So okay. I would think non-English speaking generally.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I wanted to make sure I had
that. We would go
before.
Back to the Federal Voting Rights Act to get any further clarification, but
okay.
I say non-English speaking, I guess an argument could be made that Spanish speaking is becoming less of a my language minority group, but I'm not going to go there yet. But
sure, sure.
If we had a claim and something, we'd have to look into that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? No? Okay, so our...
So no action is necessary at this
time, right.
In my view.
So we can either choose number one on the recommendation to have the city attorney develop language and go through the process of a new ordinance and public hearing, et cetera, or we can choose number two to do nothing. Do I have a motion?
I move that we do nothing at this time.
I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved by Councilor Rule and seconded by Councilor Lawrenson that we do nothing and do not change our election procedures. Are there any further questions or comments? Okay. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carried 6-0. Okay. Next up is to schedule a public hearing for the school drive street vacation. So we will have our public works director give us an explanation of where this is and what it's all about.
Yeah. This was originally, we were originally petitioned by this applicant in 2017. At that point in time, we were still working with him on the Clyde Street piece. We had a little bit backward and forward about whether or not the petition was complete and so forth. Then our code update with the street vacation kind of got started, and it took a while, as you know. So we have been communicating with the property owner. In fact, we met on site, I want to say a month ago, before the public hearing, before the public hearing on the street vacation ordinance update, which I invited him to, and he was here. In any event, now that that has passed, we've reinstituted communication with him, and we are proposing to go ahead and get started with the scheduling that public hearing. It's interesting, though, because since the site visit and since the time when he was here for the ordinance passage that occurred, he's actually changed his request such that it's addressing some of the comments that we made when we met on site. So I actually think that that's very healthy, and in some ways I think that the process as it's written now to essentially have to come with a complete application straight to MET for a public hearing, I'm thinking internally that I might want to change our internal process such that we're having more of that sit down before we do that, even though it won't be a formal part of the process and it can't be. That way we have that ability to do that. So anyway, I'm kind of reminiscing here aloud. But in any event, the code requires that we have a resolution to set a public hearing in the case of a street vacation. We actually had this conversation with senior staff about when do we come to you with a resolution and when don't we come to you with a resolution. And I think that might tie to some of Michael's discussion about quasi-judicial and so forth. This is very well prescribed in the state code about not only shall you do a resolution, but you shall have X amount of days notice and so forth. In the case of our 6-year TIP, that is not the case, and so we're not bringing you a resolution or even an action this evening for that. So accordingly, in accordance with city code and state law, we're asking that the City Council adopt Resolution 1734-18, fixing the time for a public hearing on the petition to vacate certain rights-of-way south of School Drive, between Elm Avenue and Interstate 5 and west of Elm Avenue between School Drive and Interstate 5. And it would be my intent when we have this public hearing, which we are proposing for, and we forgot the date, it's June 25th. When we do the staff report for that public hearing, I will go over what changes Mr. Saul has proposed since our meeting on site and give you more of the specifics. But I just wanted to let you know that that was a very healthy delay.
Okay, any questions? Laura Raven?
Yes. So that's young. The school owns quite a bit of that property in that block. And, you know, the staff for the school is the place that they can go except for that towards the west.
Mm-hmm.
So has anybody talked to the school how they feel about making this available so they can put their property on this piece of land?
I wasn't aware of that, in all honesty, because there's homes and stuff around there. But, yeah, I will, well, this notice will obviously go out, but I will definitely reach out to Ron hearing that. Yeah. Well, this is for rights of way, so it's not for any private property that is being under consideration. And as you could see on the petition in your packet, it's a very strange little remnant of property that was left over when I-5 went in. So I don't know what use the school would have for that kind of corner, but absolutely, if... Okay. I will definitely touch base with Ron and let him know about the public hearing and what's being proposed. Thank you for that insight.
Question? No? Okay, and we'll have our more specific information prior to the public hearing.
Well, so this is, again, the way that the state law works, and that we have not been doing the right way, and now we are, is we have a complete petition. We schedule the public hearing at the time of the public hearing, kind of like Alex and I did today with traffic impact fees. We will provide you a staff report, or I will, you can help me with that staff report, right? I will provide you a staff report prior to the public comment period.
Right. But we're talking about this little triangle.
That's
right here.
Yeah.
Right. Anybody understand where the
triangle? Yes, yeah. Where the little arrow is pointing.
Okay, right. Okay. All right. We will, we need to schedule a public hearing by adopting Resolution 1734-18. Do I have a motion to...
So moved.
Do so.
I second.
Okay, it's been moved by Councilor Lawrenson, seconded by Councilor Erickson to adopt Resolution 1734-18, fixing a public hearing for this Elm and School Drive portion of property. Okay, all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Okay, that's the end of our action items. Now we just need to move on to commission, committee, and board reports. Mr. Lawrenson, do we have a BTAC report or
no
Chamber
report
of Commerce?
For either one of my committees.
Okay. Councilor Rule, Boys and Girls Club in Port of Bellingham?
No reports.
Okay. Councilor Hawkins?
No report
on you too? Okay. And moving down to WTA board?
No reports.
Okay. Our Public Works Advisory Committee?
No report.
Okay. Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee? I don't have a report.
No.
Nope. We're only meeting every other month now, and I think we're actually going to skip a month. I was talking to Dave about skipping a month and meeting in July, so... We'll get those dates for sure. Okay, and nothing for Finance Committee or Small Cities or Council of Governments from me. I missed meetings when I was gone for 3 weeks.
Madam Mayor, may I give a brief report on the Small
Cities? Oh, yes, absolutely.
on that at the last meeting. There was a presentation by Raylene Cutink from our court, as well as from Bellingham courts, related to a jail diversion program,
yes,
which is an alternative to people going to jail and being incarcerated there. It would be like a home jail kind of situation where they wear anklets or wrist bracelets, and it's a really good alternative to people going to jail, particularly given the jail overcrowding issues that we have. So we're bringing forward the jail use agreement that we'll be asking you to enter into with Whatcom County for the upcoming year, and as part of that, we expect to bring forward a proposal for the diversion program. It's run through a nonprofit in Bellingham, and participants pay to be eligible for that, or pay what they can to participate in that, and then the city has costs, which overall it helps reduce our costs from sending someone to jail, and it gives people the ability to do things like go to work and keep their job rather than potentially lose their job when they go to jail. So they have limited mobility options. They can go to work and go straight home, that sort of thing, or maybe take care of their kids when they come home from school. That kind of thing. So it's useful in that regard. Raylene will be able to give a much more thorough presentation on that, but it was very interesting, and Bellingham is having a lot of success with it.
Mm-hmm. And that will not be directly related to the jail agreement with the county. This would be our own system. We would pay for this on our own.
Right. It's correct. Not directly related to the jail program.
Right. Just,
we happen to be bringing those both forward on the same night,
sure,
most likely, and the program is we would work with a nonprofit that provides the service, and it's not directly related to the county.
All right. I saw Raylene didn't stay, so I wasn't sure if you were going to say anything about that.
I think Mr. Davidson has a question.
So, mm-hmm.
Is that a new program just starting up in the county cities?
Bellingham's been using it for about 3 years.
But Blaine, Linden, Ferndale hasn't been using it.
We have not. And actually, it sounds like from the small cities discussion that it's very likely that Linden and Ferndale will,
sure,
probably be going on to the program as well. It sounds just like a really good alternative to spending extra money to put people in jail when it gives them an alternative. It's very interesting. They also have cuffs that can test for blood alcohol levels. So
cuffs.
If someone is, well, a bracelet that can test for blood alcohol level.
Mm-hmm.
Cuffs, probably not the right
term
to use.
Yeah. Right.
A bracelet that tests for blood alcohol levels. So if somebody, mm-hmm, if that's part of someone's sentence, it would send a notice, mm-hmm, to the system if they are under the influence of alcohol.
And is that something that each city council is going to have to vote on, whether they want to adopt that, or how does that whole administration of that
so
work?
So what we would do is we would vote to have you would authorize entering into a contract with the program, and then the judge determines what the appropriate sentence is. You don't determine the appropriate sentence, but you make that an option that's available.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean, like, can Linden give a thumbs up and Ferndale give a thumbs down, and they just go about their business, mm-hmm,
right,
as before?
Right. A nonprofit that's already in operation can enter into a contract with us individually, or with all three of those cities, or five of the small cities, or just stick with Bellingham alone if no one wants to get on board.
Okay, thank you.
But I understand ultimately this could be a cost-saving measure for the city.
Yeah,
in lieu of jail.
It does appear that it can be a cost-savings measure overall.
And at the same time, ease the burden on the jail,
right,
which is very much a concern as well. So Raylene will give us details on that. Okay, so we have department reports now. Do we have a public reports project update?
Well, I think the most important thing that I have to update you on is that we do have a new assistant public works director, and he will be starting on June 18th.
And what is his name?
His name is Samuel Castro.
Does he go by Samuel or Sam?
We're trying to get him to go by Samuel, but I think he's probably going to go by Sam, judging by the communication we've had. I definitely will send out a release to the press as well as City Hall, kind of giving the highlights of his experience and background. But just to say is exactly what we were looking for. So
you'll bring him to the meeting after he starts?
He's actually coming in the week before he starts officially, and I told him, there is a city council meeting there that Monday, but no obligation. if he doesn't choose to come on his own time, we will certainly bring him to introduce you all. Absolutely. And so, yeah, very, very excited. Let's see, what else? I think I reported last month that we've been working with the Department of Commerce on the East Bay Infrastructure Grant. So there's a bit of paperwork associated with that, and the Department of Commerce gets to take a little nip right off the top of that for their assistance. We met this morning with WashDOT about exit 274, and so I think we've got some interesting strategies to work with the IJR while still furthering along the idea of the grade separation, recognizing that one might go more slowly or one might get funded differently, and so looking at that. I think I mentioned in the last week that, or last meeting, that there was a National Public Works Week last week, and I wanted to point out to that all of the public works vehicles, you'll start seeing a special bumper sticker that says First Responder Public Works. So we're not taking the red and white of our police and fire brethren, but it's orange and black to kind of emphasize public works. So APWA actually designed and distributed those. So I'm excited about seeing those up on our trucks, vehicles. I mentioned earlier about the change in procedure about scheduling public hearings, and that we're not going to be coming to you for action to schedule the one for the six-year TIP, but that is being proposed for your first meeting in June, so that we don't have two public hearings in one night if we can help it, because the street vacation required to have that longer notice period. And I think that's it, unless you have any questions. Yes, sir.
Raven, just one quick question. One, first of all, let me say the improvements at the Senior Center Boys and Girls Club, fantastic. Glad to see the curbs went in. Do we have a date on when we're going to close the 8th Street entrance?
We need to meet with Kathy Sitker. She, apparently their food delivery truck is saying they can't get around a parked car where the new entrance is. So I need to kind of understand that a little bit better, because they're getting around those 90-degree turns leaving the site now. But I think that's really the only thing. The bollards that we were going to put there, so I already had made the decision not to raise the curb on 8th Street, but just to put some collapsible bollards in to allow for, if we do have a need to get closer to the building with emergency vehicles, to being able to do that. And so they're sitting in Cole Curcio's yard and ready to go in. So
if need be, we could have, for delivery trucks, it could have something. They must deliver in the morning, like the fire truck. Something could
come. That's kind of a conversation I want to have with her. She was saying that they were interested in coming in off G Street, but there's not a good connection to the kitchen from there. Since when I saw the email exchange, I was like, you know what, I need to meet you on site and discuss this. And today, I was gone Friday, and I haven't heard from her since I met her Thursday. So,
thank you.
But, yeah, thank you for the feedback. I appreciate it.
Okay. Next is Community Development Services.
Thank you.
I wanted to run through this presentation, which I gave to the Planning Commission, with you rather quickly and get a sense from you whether or not you want more information and a more thorough review of this in an upcoming meeting. And I do have some feedback for you from the Planning Commission on what some of their perspective was. So first of all, it's related to a density credit program. Under our interlocal agreement with Whatcom County, our interlocal agreement for long-range planning, one of the things that's included, among many things related to annexation and comprehensive planning, is to consider a density credit program, which would help to shift density from potential development in the county in rural areas like agricultural and forestry lands into urban areas by giving benefits or incentives to do that. Not incentives so much as, but allowing people to build greater density in urban areas. So a density credit is a right to build a unit. Typically it's a housing unit, but it could be other things like height could be a unit or square footage could be a unit. But it, for argument's sake, it's easier to talk about a housing unit. And it's transferable or portable. You can take it. Once you've purchased that right from a bank, if you will, operated by an entity like the county, you can put it on a site wherever there is an eligible site. The eligibility locations would be determined by the cities and the county as far as where they wanted more density or where more density was appropriate. And then the places where it was retired would be also determined through the program. Those rights would typically be retired in places, like I mentioned, like agricultural or forestry lands, in resource lands. So the key is it's kind of like the ability to buy a development right and move it from one place to another. There are already programs like that that are transferable development right programs or purchase of development right programs, but in those instances, you're talking about a specific right on a specific property to buy it and move it. In a transferable program, there's actually a negotiation between two property owners to transfer them. In the purchase program, you can purchase them and move them in a similar method, but it's less direct involvement of the two property owners. In a density credit program, we'd step further away from that property owner to property owner negotiation and actually let people just walk in and say, I'd like to do some additional density on this site under the program that's available, and I'm paying, here's my X dollars to pay for those credits. They'd buy those credits. And then it wouldn't be tied to a specific place where they were retiring density or retiring development units. However, the money that was accumulated would then be used to go out and purchase away and retire development rights in the county. So the development rights are typically related to things. Think of it this way. If you owned 80 acres of farmland in Whatcom County, and it was 80 acres of raspberries, well, 75 acres of raspberries and 5 acres of farm where you have your house and some outbuildings and things like that that support the 75 acres of raspberries. But it's zoned one unit per 10 acres. You would arguably be able to build 7 more units on that property, right? You have one house. It's 80 acres. Do the math. You can have 7 more houses. Well, if you divide up that property into 10-acre lots, 8 of them, put homes on them, roads in there, septics, yards, all those things, you suddenly don't have very much land left for raspberries. So when it's divided that way and developed that way, it hampers the agricultural development. It would do the same thing to productive forestry lands. It would pretty much eliminate the ability to have mineral resource extraction, gravel quarries, if you develop the land that way. And so what happens is, if people develop at the densities that are permitted, we lose a tremendous amount of agricultural production, forestry production, and other things like that, things that are the underpinnings of the economy to some degree. So the idea is to create a program that allows those units to be expired while also still paying the property owners or giving them the benefit that they had, at least some of the benefit that they had, related to owning those rights and owning that land. Because, again, we'll go back to that farmer on the raspberry field. If you were that farmer and you were getting ready to retire and you had kids that you were trying to put through college and you had this land that was very valuable because it had this development right, if you could sell off some of those, you might be able to send your kids to college. If you could sell off some of those, you might be able to retire in a different way than otherwise. If they all go away through a matter of things like zoning, changing the zoning from 1 per 10 acres to 1 per 80 acres, you lose a tremendous amount of value. I don't think there's the political will in the county council to do that. there'd probably be a lot of backlash from those communities. But on the other hand, we also want to protect, I think, as Whatcom County citizens as a whole, generally people want to protect the way of life, and the way of life includes great big agricultural properties that are beautiful to drive through and that we get raspberries from and that infuse money into the economy. And, you know, it's not just raspberries, but many things like that, right? It's part of our scenery. It's part of our lifestyle. So the idea is to develop incentives that people can buy to add in. I'm going to stick just with the dwelling units and not talk about these other things. So we would, as a city, potentially, again, we're just asked to consider this, but we as a city would potentially consider certain zoning districts where we would allow more density in if you purchased, particular areas, neighborhoods maybe, that are not related necessarily to a zoning district, but like downtown, for example, would be multiple zoning districts, but you could set a geographic area. One of the other things that was considered was the idea of doing it in areas that are currently in the UGA but outside the city limits. So in order to be able to develop at the density when you annex, you would purchase some of those rights or all of those rights. Or another option is even a further step out is to, in order to expand a UGA, you would have to purchase the rights in that expanded UGA. One of the arguments for that is that that land, when it's not in the UGA, is only valuable at a certain degree, which is one dwelling unit per 10 acres, typically. When it comes into the UGA, it's now all of a sudden valuable at 5 dwelling units per acre. So the density goes up tremendously, and there's theoretically a windfall, if you will, to that property owner that when it was added into the UGA. Maybe that's a place where it's capitalized and some of that money is transferred into a program that then retires rights outside, in further outside the UGA, out in the rural areas. So the whole discussion goes around, well, how do you determine price? Where does the money go? Does it all go just to retire rights? Or if the city's taking in additional density, should the city receive some of those funds and then use it for things that maintain high quality of life or improve quality of life? When we bring more people into the city, there are more expenses. We have fees for that. We talked about them tonight. You increased them. And we have a program that balances those things out at an acceptable level. If we're asked to bring in more density, maybe there's a reason that the city should be getting some of those funds, and it could be used for things like other amenities, and I'll mention some of the ideas. So how could it be spent? There's a variety of ways, sidewalks, trails, community art. A lot of these things we already have funding mechanisms for, but it would potentially shift some of the burden, less need perhaps to increase impact fees if the money were coming from another direction, or for things that we don't really have programs for, we might be able to add. We might be able to fund something that we aren't already able to do. One of the other things that was important to the Planning Commission was this topic, which was geographic connection to the city. Somehow having these retired rights be relevant to us. If you're retiring rights in the Nooksack Valley, way out by Van Zandt and Welcome down Highway 9, other than the warm fuzzy feeling that you might get from knowing that you're preserving agricultural land, it probably has no impact to you at all. But if you're preserving agricultural land between here and Birch Bay, maintaining separation between the communities and keeping some open space near Blaine, even if it's not public open space, it's still rural character, that might have some value to some people. So there's different contexts related to that. The other thing was things like watershed values, like preserve, if Blaine were participating in the program, preserve land in the Drayton Harbor watershed, in the Dakota Creek watershed, in the California Creek watershed, so that that stays rural, has fewer homes, fewer septics, less impervious surface, hopefully leading to maintaining water quality or improving water quality over time in the harbor. So that idea of where, well, sort of the, if you will, what's in it for us, right? So that's about all I have. That was a really quick version of what we talked about at Planning Commission, and they had lots of questions. But what I'd like to do is mention to you what some of their, if my computer participates here, mention to you what some of their thoughts were on it. And what I'd like to, again, get from you is whether you'd like a larger presentation about this and consider whether or not the city wants to start pursuing it, or if generally what I should report back to Whatcom County is, well, we've considered it, and we're not interested at this time. Because we are under an agreement to consider it, but not necessarily take any action. I will say the county is very motivated, and they're likely to bring this up more than once. So, you know, we can say no. It'll probably resurface in the future, but that doesn't mean we can't say, you know, no now. Or on the other hand, you might say yes. So overall, most of the commissioners were generally not in favor of the idea, mostly because this added a complication to our zoning concepts, and that we've already gone through a really long process to develop a comprehensive plan and development regulations that reflect what we're trying to achieve as a city. And this is sort of inserting something new into that. One of the things is, in some areas, for example, if we want more density, we just allow it because we want more density. Or we incentivize it rather than charge people for it. Downtown would be an example of that. We said you can have as much density as you can fit on the site, right? And we're looking at ways to even incentivize people to build those housing units. So there's the general overview. But I say here that the various things I'll mention, that the commission, as it might have only been one person that mentioned it, so I don't want you to think it was all seven of the or all six of the commissioners, because that's all we have right now. It wasn't necessarily all of them, but at least one or two people mentioned some of these things. The commission appreciated the negative impact on the county if those rural lands densified, but overall, they felt that this was a county problem that really needed a county solution, or at least primarily a county solution. The density that's been approved out there from historical zoning that's still in place today isn't really our issue. The commission was concerned about benefits that would be accrued far from the city, but that the impacts would be local. You know, local benefits became a really important topic. So if there was any movement on it, that was clear that they would expect to include that in anything that they would recommend to you. They were concerned that the program would probably add cost to development in the city. So overall, if you just on a unit per unit basis did an average, if people were participating in this, it would make the cost higher, at least for some people. They did think that it was a unique opportunity to potentially fund some things that we don't really have the ability to fund, like a neighborhood grant program or a community art grant program. So things where, you know, if a neighborhood wants to get together and do like a neighborhood beautification, well, where do those funds come from now? It's hard for us to come up with those dollars. But potentially this could be a funding stream for that. It's not going to be a huge amount of money very likely, but it could. It could do some things that are interesting that we're not really, we don't have the available funds to take care of right now. Another one that came up was the idea of a tax relief aspect of it, where if we're getting these funds coming in for adding extra density, maybe that can just be used to support the general fund, thereby avoiding other tax increases to people. The challenge that I have with that one is that's taking a long-term impact. The density will be there essentially forever, and giving the benefit to those who are paying taxes in year number one or year zero of that continuum. So all the citizens of Lane from now on are going to have additional neighbors and a more dense neighborhood, for example. But this year, I got a tax break. That, to me, that seems like we're putting the money in the wrong place. But that is a possibility. And then the other one was, of all the things that were discussed, the idea of UGA expansion seemed to be most palatable, because there is kind of a recognition of this idea of, yeah, maybe there is a windfall, or maybe there is a bump in value that those people get, and maybe it's really fair to harvest some of that value and use it to protect rural areas in other locations. So that's about all the commission had to say. They generally were not gung-ho by any means, and they wanted me to relay that to you. At this point, I'm really just interested in finding out, would you like more information? I could have some county planners come give a presentation on the issue, the number of units that are out there, what they're talking about, kind of more globally, or I can present more information from community development. We can come forward with more information. You can refer to the Planning Commission, or you can just decide we're good. We're not interested in a whole lot more info. It looks like Mr. Hawkins has a comment. Ma'am.
It seems like there's an awful lot of land in Washington County that's not close to any cities that isn't good for farmland. Why are they not looking to do that in areas that isn't like the farmland? Just because it's in the county doesn't mean it's farmland or available good for farmland.
There are actually looking at some of that. So some of the programs that the county is considering related to this would be the idea of potentially increasing the density in some of those areas so that people could develop at a higher density. The challenge is the Growth Management Act has established a concept of rural as lower density of like 1 unit per 5 acres, although it's called a bright line, and it was overturned by the courts, but the courts left us with this concept that, well, you still have to have a rural number or some kind of rural concept. So they are looking at that in some places, but the challenge is the county can't really urbanize or densify areas too much. Now, they're looking at it for Birch Bay, Columbia Valley, you know, their urban growth areas. But in just out in that undesirable land, they can probably only go to 1 unit per 5 acres, and they can probably only add 1 accessory dwelling unit per site. So basically it's 1 unit per 2.5 acres, but they are looking at some of those options. No, it would have to be lobbied in. There's no proposal coming forward at this point. Mm-hmm.
Michael, is there a problem in the county, though? One of the things limiting further density is the water supply. I mean, I've heard that from Jim McKinney.
Well, it is, but the Hearst decision has, there's been a solution established by the legislature, so okay. it's essentially resolved. Now, there's still a lot of work to be done on it, but there's no longer the kind of moratorium that was in place before.
Okay. A temporary solution has been
right,
located.
A temporary solution. So,
I would look to being open to this. I think we just need more information. I wouldn't want to say no at the surface level before we find out more from what's being proposed. I think it's vague. We don't know numbers. We don't know what that would play out for our city. I think we should look into it. Perhaps it's a funding stream for projects that we have blocked off as non-feasible to, because we just think, oh, we don't have the opportunity to do that. I don't know. I think we should look into it. I think that we work together. I think we have a tiny city, and that I feel like as a citizen, my family and I are part of the city and the county and the state and the country, and that we look at how could we work together.
I think it's kind of ironic. Anybody else have a comment? Go ahead, Eric.
I agree with Assemblyman Councilwoman Rule about that. I would like to get more information, maybe from somebody from the county to come and speak with us. I'm hesitant to push this on the Planning Commission because I know that there's 7 or 6 people who volunteer their time and are overwhelmed with stuff. But I wouldn't mind listening to somebody for 20 or 30 minutes about this. But to get just because we don't have a lot of information just yet.
So the. It would be the developer buying the density credits.
Right.
The city would not, even in the case of the UGA, the city would not be purchasing.
No, it would always be the developer, the person who is going to profit on the sale of the units.
I think it's kind of ironic in a way because the county's trying to discourage the farmers who have the right to put 5 houses per acre if they so choose. And in order to discourage that and to keep it as farmland, they're wanting to institute this program and hope everybody buys into that program. But on the other hand, it seems like both the state and the county are making it all the harder for farmers to make a living. You know, I mean, they say they want it kept as agricultural, and then all these regulations keep piling on the farmers. I just want to make that comment. It's just kind of an irony to me. But I'd be willing to get more information just to make a more educated decision on this, whether we really want to pursue it, whether it's really going to have the impact we think it might have on our community. So
we would take the following then, based, I think, on, I guess I don't want to cut anyone off, but any other comments? So what I'll recommend then is that we'll probably ask the county to come in to present at a study session, give some more information on the overall concept, and then if council, if any council member feels like it's something that should become an action item, we'll put it on as a resolution to initiate it with the Planning Commission, because I agree very much with Mr. Davidson. I do not want to send this to the Planning Commission and have them do a whole bunch of work on it and come to you all and say, no, we really didn't want to do this that much anyway, because it will be a lot of work to develop it. As the commission said, the devil's in the details, and getting the details put together could take a long time. Now, one thing to say is we're not in it on our own. It will not be like just our program. We'll decide how we want to do it, where we want it to apply, those kinds of things.
Right.
But we won't be building the whole ship, so to speak.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks. Okay, we have some calendar dates on the agenda here. And as far as unfinished business, I just wanted to be sure that Mr. Urich's and Mr. Wendt's traffic concerns were addressed. Mr. Urich's communication was addressed to City Council with you copied and the police chief, but he has several things on here. It would be a lot to address them, but in one way or another, we need to get back to him.
And we've asked also Chief Knapp to contact him or prepare a response. It is a lot of information. On the one related to the tsunami map, it's a Whatcom County tsunami map, and he directed that communication to Whatcom County. And
right.
He told us, I sent this to Whatcom County. We weren't planning a response related to
that. No, and he didn't ask for a response.
Right, and generally, although there are some minor errors on the map is generally accurate, and people, they might be going down wrong. They might be looking for Cherry Street, but any of the streets that run parallel to Cherry Street are fine. And there are a couple of things that need to be corrected, but I don't think it's going to lead to a disaster.
Okay. And then Mr. Wendt also.
Yeah.
We're going to take care of him. Okay. So is there any new business? No? Sure. Come on up.
When John made comments regarding the changing of the wards, one of the things that didn't come up was a dilution factor. And the dilution factor is when the wards select their candidates, their vote gets diluted by 2/3 in the general election. And you're supposed to have one person, one vote. And that vote becomes 1/3 of a vote. And I think that needs to be addressed some way. I was really concerned that it didn't come up. It has nothing to do with, you know, your race or anything else. It has to do with the fact that you are allowed to have one vote as one person. And the candidates that you are voting for represent you in that ward. Mm-hmm. And by diluting it 2/3, and this happened in the last election, the candidates favored by the folks in the ward, their candidate didn't win the election. And there's something wrong with that, I think. So I don't know whether there's a way to think about this again and take this into consideration, because that's the primary concern I have with what's going on with the election in Blaine. I moved here into town 15 years ago, and the first election in the ward that I was in, the person that got the most votes didn't win the seat on the council. And I think that's wrong. That's what I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
And Bonnie, I got a sheet I'll leave with you, and it's all marked up, and you can do with it whatever you wish.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, speaking for myself, I understood where you were coming from in bringing this forward. I knew it didn't have to do with the state's initial, you know, making this available and the emphasis on race and all of that. I understood that. But even so, my personal feelings are in having only ward-only voting. I think it may, although I know it would provide the opportunity for what you are wanting, that the people in that ward are the ones to get to vote for their representation. But on the other hand, you can kind of look at it another way, and I believe the city as a whole should have the opportunity to vote for a candidate. While they may live in a different neighborhood, a different ward, I may think that they're just off base in the way they're approaching what they want for the city as a whole. As a whole. Well, I just disagree with that. I think that would tend to kind of separate us into these three distinct neighborhoods, while I think every council member should have the entire city in mind. Yeah. But we're still guaranteed two people from each ward. So we have representation.
It's not the people on the council, it's how they got there.
Yeah, okay.
To be legitimate in terms of, you know, I got the right to elect the person
Madam Mayor, just as a point of order, Mr. Olson should speak from the microphone if you're going to.
Well, speak. Okay. I think we all heard you fine, and I think we all agree that the system we have now, we still have representation of wards, and I wouldn't want to do away with that because I think it's good to have all the areas represented. How did that change? How would that change? Well, okay. We just have a different philosophy.
Again, my point that I still think needs to be brought up is having a special primary election that costs us money just to knock off one candidate out of three, rather than putting the three candidates on in the November election and letting the people decide that. Do we really want to spend that amount of money to hold basically a special election to remove one candidate out of three or two candidates out of four so that only two go forward into
I guess that's kind of a different discussion.
Well, that's, I don't know, I think part of the discussion.
Yeah.
You're talking about eliminating the essentially the primary election.
Yes. Yeah. As I say, being that we're nonpartisan, we are not here as a representative of any party, so we don't need to remove the other people from our same party to go forward. It's different than the national election.
Yeah, true.
And it's costing us money. That's my point.
Okay. Well, we agreed to let things ride as they are for right now. So it's a matter for a future discussion, I suppose. But anyway, okay. I will adjourn the meeting.